You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
The Astros have added some depth to their starting pitching ranks by agreeing to a two-year deal with Charlie Morton. We're joined on the line by MLB.com Astros reporter Brian McTaggart. And Brian, Morton missed most of the 2016 season after tearing his hamstring. What do the Astros expect to get from him? Where does he fit into that rotation for 2017?
Well, they're hoping to get about 30 starts from him, and that's, you know, something he's never done in his career. His career high is 29 starts with the Pirates, and that was 5 years ago. But, you know, they feel if he's healthy, that with the kind of ground ball stuff that he has and the curve ball that he has, that they feel he could be a guy they can put in the middle of the rotation. And he's going to sort of serve the role that Doug Fister had last year. They signed Fister to a one-year deal, ground ball pitcher. Fister turned out having a really good 4 months and then really cratered towards the end of the season. So I think the number one thing is the Astros are just hoping that he's healthy. I mean, this is a guy that has had four surgeries in the last 5 years, but he does have some tools, and they're really excited about his ground ball rate, which in his career is second in baseball behind Dallas Keuchel. And with the kind of shifting the Astros do with their infield defense, they think they can turn a lot of those ground balls into outs, which will really help him. And you know, Brett Strom has done a nice job with some of these guys that have come over through the years, the pitching coach. You know, he has a high spin rate on his curveball. And Colin McHugh, when they got him off waivers, same thing, high spin rate off the curveball. And Brett Strom was able to work wonders with him and turned him into a 19-game winner. So, yeah, they're paying him $14 million over 2 years. It's kind of surprising, but if they can plug him in that middle of the rotation, he stays healthy and he can give them, 25, 30 starts, I think they'll call it a success.
As far as that rotation goes, Brian, is this probably it as far as additions, or could they stay busy this hot stove season and add another starter?
Well, I think if they add another starter, it's going to be a big-time move, and, you know, I don't know if they're going to do that. You know, you look at the rotation right now, you know, Keuchel had a down year and got injured towards the end, and, you know, they're going to be banking on him to come back healthy, and if he does, you have a Cy Young winner at the top of your rotation. Colin McHugh, a 19-game winner a couple of years ago, pitched pretty well in the second half last year. You can do battle with him. If Lance McCullers is healthy, he's a number two starter. Joe Musgrove, a rookie, came on last year. Now you have guys like Mike Fiers and Morton in the mix. So they do have a rotation. And if you remember last year, the Astros pretty much stuck with six guys in the rotation through July, did not make a move at the trade deadline. And then, lo and behold, as they got into August, Dallas Keuchel and Lance McCullers got hurt, and they were really hurting in starting pitching. So I wouldn't surprise me if they go out and grab another starter. But as far as making a really impactful move, I think that would be via trade. You know, I don't know if they're going to be in the mix for Sale or Archer, any of those guys. So this could be it as far as starting rotation goes. But I do think they have several more moves to come when it comes to offense.
Yeah, when you talk about that offense, it sounds like this could be the year where the Astros kind of return to being major players as far as free agency or maybe even the trade market. You know, first base is obviously a thing there. I mean, you still have prospects on the way, but is that the most likely place? An outfielder? You hear names like Edwin Encarnacion, Miguel Cabrera maybe being available. I mean, could the Astros really get involved in some big-time free agents and available players this hot stove season?
Yeah, I think they will. And, I mean, just based on what Jeff Luhnow has told us about, they want to be aggressive. They feel that this is their window. This is their contention window. They have this young nucleus they keep talking about, and it's there, and it's real with Gurriel, Altuve, Correa, Springer, Evan Gattis. You can put him in there. And then, the rotation and then the additions they made to the bullpen the last couple of years. They feel they're poised to make a run at this. And, you know, I think they will try to get one of those impact bats. I think outfield is a certainty that they will add somebody. You know, they're going to lose, you know, Colby Rasmus. I don't think they're going to bring him back. So there's going to be a hole there. You know, catcher, they need a catcher. Jason Castro is a free agent. They don't have a starting catcher right now. Brian McCann would be ideal. They can make a trade with the Yankees, get a left-handed bat for a veteran catcher to split time with Gattis. That would be just a perfect situation. You know, first base, it was kind of a revolving door last season. They do have some options there. Like you said, A.J. Reed didn't do well, but he's going to be back in the mix. Gurriel, who they signed, the Cuban free agent they signed, he could play some first base. So they do have some options there, but I certainly think outfield and catcher, for sure, the Astros are going to acquire one of each from those positions, and I think it should be a couple of the bigger names on the market.
The Astros have made another move already this offseason and adding Alex Cora as the bench coach. He's obviously been working at ESPN since the time when he retired. He's also, I know, GM of his hometown team back in Puerto Rico as well. What stood out to the Astros as far as adding Cora back in uniform and back in a dugout?
Well, he's had a relationship with A.J. Hinch for quite some time, and in fact, the Astros tried to hire him even before Hinch was manager, when Bo Porter was manager, and the time just wasn't right for Cora. But they think he brings a vast breadth of skills to the table from his time as a player. You know, 13 years in the major leagues, his time in Puerto Rico with the World Baseball Classic, also his time as a general manager in Puerto Rico. He's got great people skills. He knows the game, base running, and defense. He's going to handle the infielders, so. He's not going to be your really traditional bench coach. Yeah, he's going to have some of those duties, but he's going to be very hands-on when it comes to the infielders and the base running, and they're going to try to utilize him as much as possible. So they just felt this was the guy. A.J. Hinch thought this was the guy from day one that they wanted, and they were able to get it done. So, you know, he's got a good track record, a good resume, and, you know, a couple of players who played for him in winter ball emailed me the last couple of days and said, hey, we love this guy. So, early returns are great, and it'll be great to have a guy with his kind of experience with Hinch now entering his third year as manager of the Astros.
One more for you, Brian. The American League MVP award will be announced on Thursday. Obviously, Jose Altuve, one of the finalists there. What's the biggest reason that he should win MVP?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think if you look at just his consistency all year, you know, this is a guy that hit, I think, what, 344 before the All-Star break, maybe 341 after the All-Star break. He was terrific on the road as he was at home. And if you look what he meant to the Astros, I mean, if you look at some of his stats and the Astros wins, if they won, Jose Altuve's fingerprints were all over it. He added the power stroke this year with the 24 homers, almost 100 RBIs, stole 30 bases, played in almost every game. You know, you just look at the numbers. They are all there. And, you know, he did falter a little bit in September. He got tired like a lot of players did. And, you know, he's going up against some very tough competition with Mike Trout and Mookie Betts. You know, it's going to be really tough for him to win it. But this was the best season of his career. His bat-to-ball skills are second to none. And if you just look at what he meant to the Astros, he was just the heart and soul of a team that for 3 months had the best record in the American League, played the best ball in the American League, and he was a big reason why. He hit in the top spot in the order, hit well. He hit in the third spot in the order, hit well. Did everything the Astros asked him to do and did it very well.
I love that all three finalists this year in the American League are complete guys, guys that play great defense and also excel, obviously, at the plate. It'll be fun to find out who gets that MVP award. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Astros edition. For Brian McTaggart, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.
On Thursday, the A's had a big ownership shakeup with Lou Wolf stepping down as the managing partner. And he will be replaced by John Fisher, who, of course, was already a co-owner of the team. But now he is the big man on campus, and he has brought in Dave Cavall as his new president. And Cavall replaces Michael Crowley, who was president of the A's for nearly 20 years. So both Lou Wolf and Michael Crowley will remain in the organization, but they have both relinquished their titles. And it's a big change for an organization that I think has been kind of starving for any change, really. And I think the A's feel this is the best way to move forward, particularly when considering, you know, their stadium situation and a need for a new stadium. I mean, it's been clear for over a decade now that they're in need of a new stadium, and there's really no evidence in these last few years that they've really done much. There hasn't been much effort, you know, in pushing forward with it. But these changes, I think, is a big step in the right direction. Dave Cavall already has experience with building a stadium. He's also president of the San Jose Earthquake soccer team, a role which he will still maintain. He'll just kind of hand over a lot of his duties to some other people with Earthquakes, but he'll still maintain that role while also working with the A's, and he is a new point man with the A's, and he will be, you know, guiding their stadium search, having already helped build a new stadium for the Earthquakes a few years ago. So, you know, that experience obviously is big. no, this is kind of a whole different animal dealing with, you know, a baseball stadium and also, you know, trying to build a privately funded stadium in the city of Oakland where the Raiders, you know, are still in the mix. The Warriors aren't out yet. They do have plans to move out into a new stadium in San Francisco soon, but that hasn't happened. So a lot of things really in limbo that could affect the A's, particularly the Raiders situation. So I really don't see anything concrete happening with the A's until the Raiders figure out their situation and whether they're moving to Las Vegas, whether Los Angeles is still in the mix, or whether they do indeed want to stay put here in Oakland. That will definitely impact the A's, but the A's also see their situation as being a separate entity, and you know they want to press forward no matter what the Raiders do. And you know, while also realizing that that is a big factor, but you know, moving forward and looking and reviewing several sites in Oakland. I mean, they've made it clear at this point. Rob Manfred has made it clear that you know, the A's want to stay in Oakland, and they have narrowed their search to Oakland sites, and there are several of them. And you know, that remained clear yesterday when Dave Cavall was talking to the media for the first time. I don't think anything's changed in that regard, but he stressed, you know, he's putting a fresh set of eyes on these stadium sites, and there is word that, I mean, they could select a site within the next few months. Now, whether that happens, who knows? There's obviously been so much talk and so little action here in these last few years. So it will be interesting whether, you know, this change in guard, you know, affects the process and whether they actually are really serious about it or just kind of, you know, continuing to play the waiting game and using the Raiders and other factors, you know, as a little bit of an excuse. So, you know, if they do indeed pick a site within the next 6 months, I mean, it's probable that the A's could have a new stadium as early as 2019. Maybe 2020 is a bit more realistic. But, you know, I think it's all the changes, you know, within the ownership that happened yesterday. I think it's promising for the A's fan base just in knowing that there is change and there is action and they are wanting to, you know, to do things and to make action and to move forward with the stadium process, because I know it's been a long wait already and it's going to continue to be a wait, but hopefully there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and you know, hopefully within the next few months at least, the A's can put forth a timeline, which they haven't been willing to do to this point. So the A's will enter the winter meetings with a pretty big to-do list, namely the outfield. I mean, I don't think it's any secret that they're lacking greatly in outfield depth. I mean, everywhere in their system, and there's just no clear answer in a lot of areas next year as far as who will be joining Chris Davis in the outfield. Now, obviously, Mark Canha will be back, and you know, I could easily see him taking over in right field, but the A's are in need of a center fielder, and I mean, their options are pretty limited. I mean, the outfield market already is limited, and the best options out there are presumably out of the A's price range. I mean, we've already seen Josh Reddick go off the board to an A's division opponent, the Astros, who picked up Reddick, I believe it was for 4 years and $52 million, which was a little, I think it was a very good deal. It fits right in with, I think, how much Reddick is worth. But at the same time, I think everyone kind of expected his value to be greater at this time of the year. I think his dip in production with the Dodgers maybe hurt his value a little bit. And, you know, to see that number, you can't help but think that it was a number the A's could have probably met and afforded. And I think it was that fourth year from the very beginning when the two sides began talking that was really the hurdle. I think the A's wanted to stick with 3 years. And I think Josh would have taken less money to get to that fourth year. And so I think it was a little unfortunate to see, you know, the two sides not being able to come to agreement, because Josh was obviously a fan favorite in Oakland. And, I mean, the production he gave them when healthy, you know, it can't be overstated. So without him as an option, you know, it'll be interesting to see where the A's go next. The bigger names on the board, guys like Ian Desmond and Carlos Beltran and Dexter Fowler, I just don't see, you know, the A's spending money on guys like that. So they might have to, you know, get a little creative, and whether that means making a trade, you know, I definitely wouldn't be surprised to see that. Now, you know, in regards to other trades, I know Sonny Gray's name has been out there a lot already. It's not surprising his name has been circulating, you know, the trade rumors, you know, for more than a year. And I think everyone just assumes that this is a guy that at some point Billy Beane is going to trade, just given, you know, Beane's track record of making such big splashes in the trade market. And, you know, maybe he was expected to go even earlier at the trade deadline this year, if not for a dip in his production and, you know, some of the health issues that came up with him. But I do see him as being, I mean, just the ultimate trade chip in Billy Beane's pocket. And, you know, whether he decides to use that and, you know, get another big haul. I mean, we've already seen from the Reddick and Rich Hill trade with the Dodgers, you know, the talent brought back in that deal. So many young pitchers, notably Jarrell Cotton, who should be a big part of the rotation next year. I mean, the A's clearly aren't afraid to make a deal like that. And as much as, you know, it would be nice to see the A's keep one of their fan favorites and see them build around a guy like Sonny Gray, who's under club control for several more years, it just, you know, at this point, I don't think it would shock anyone if he was on the move. And especially just given their rotation depth already. I mean, they have so many options going into next year. And, you know, so I don't think that would prevent them from making a trade. So I think that will be probably, you know, the biggest name when the A's go into the meetings early December. And, you know, outside of outfield help, you know, I think just smaller, versatile pieces could help. And they also have some other trade pieces. Maybe a guy like Jed Lowry could be on the move, and maybe one of their veteran relievers, someone like John Axford or Ryan Matson. So I do expect them to be active. They always are, whether it's at the meetings or shortly after or a few weeks after, remains to be seen. But, you know, I definitely expect them to be very active in conversations and, you know, to kind of move forward with an offseason that, you know, probably mirrors many of the ones we've already seen with them being very busy.
The offseason is upon us, but that means that it's hot stove time, which can be very interesting for fans all across the country, especially the ones paying attention to the Texas Rangers. Let's talk to T.R. Sullivan about what's going on so far. I'm Allison Fitter. T.R., okay, so I logged on to the Rangers website, and the first thing I see is a little Chris Sale chatter. So let's talk about that a little bit because it's fun. You seem, I don't know, it seems maybe there are some realistic chances that the Rangers could get him, but I don't know. Our last conversation, we also acknowledged the fact that the farm system might be a little depleted given the moves that they've made. So where do you see this possibly going, and what kind of chances would you give it?
It all depends, Allison, on how the White Sox want this done. If they want, last summer when this thing was going down, we kept hearing how the White Sox wanted four ready major leaguers. And I think the Rangers traded half of those guys away in their other trade. So they don't have that many this offseason. What the Rangers do have is a couple of guys ready for the big leagues, like obviously Jerks and Profar, Joey Gallo, guys like that. But they have some very impressive young talent way, way down in the system. And that could be very valuable. For instance, if you go back to the Rangers in 2007 when they traded Mark Teixeira, two guys that got Elvis Andrus and Neftali Feliz, they were both in the lower minor league systems of the Braves, and we all know how that ended up turning out for the Rangers. So if the White Sox are willing to take young players we're two or three years away, then I think the Rangers have a better chance than if the White Sox want guys that are ready to play in the major leagues right now.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, we all know that there's a certain window that teams have to win. Other, you know, some organizations are elite and special, and they're able to just keep this thing going year after year. Others kind of have to retool. So I guess in a way, would it be a signal? I mean, if they were to pull off something, and the White Sox did accept some of these lower level guys, it's almost like saying, you know, a couple years down the road, things could be thin a little bit. I guess the fan base would have to buy into that.
Well, the Rangers don't believe in windows, and John Daniels made that very clear. He said if we do our jobs right, then we should be able to put a contender out every year. But Daniels is also very much of the mindset, kind of what you were talking about, is if you got a chance to win right now, then you pull out all the stops, which they did last summer when they went for Jonathan LaCroix and Carlos Beltran, and of course, Cole Hamels the year before. So if there is a chance for the Rangers to get Chris Sale and they can work something out with the White Sox, I would imagine that John Daniels would be willing to do it, although in his mind that will not be being mortgaging the future.
So let's talk about Derek Holland a little bit. Just kind of you know, the decisions that had to be made about him, and you know, where you sort of see that.
Well, the Rangers did not want to pay Derek Holland $11.5 million, so they made him a free agent. And I think Derek is finding out there that there are teams that are interested in him. And this guy, I think, is 29, 30 years old. I'm not quite sure, but he's still in the prime of his career. Obviously, he's had 3 years of injuries that have really, you know, hurt him. But, you know, this guy has also been a very good talent. You know, he's been a 16-game winner. He's been a frontline pitcher on World Series teams. I think he's the guy, that kind of guy that teams are really going to take a hard look at this winter and say, and this is a guy we could take a gamble on, and he may pay off big time for us. You see teams do that every winter. You know, just off the top of my head, guys that have made comebacks are guys like Francisco Liriano and Edison Volquez, guys like that who ended up being, you know, having a little dip in their career and then coming back strong. And I mean, you know, Derek Holland could be one of those guys, and I think clubs are really investigating that possibility.
Yeah, I think he's going to be one of the top guys that people are going to look at. He's just still got so much upside. And finally, just Ian Desmond rejected the qualifying offer. He's a free agent now. This is very standard. Only a couple guys accept the qualifying offer. So this didn't come as any big surprise. So if he were to pitch for, or if, I'm sorry, if he were to sign with somebody else, then the Rangers get a comp pick, correct?
Correct. So, yeah, I think with Desmond, this guy is getting to the point where in his career where he needs his big contract. You know, players that get 28, 29, they've had 6, 7, 8 years in the big leagues. They're looking for that big, you know, career setting, you know, security contract. And, you know, he was hoping to get it last year and it didn't materialize. He had an excellent season for the Rangers this year. And he's an outfielder. There's always in demand. I think he's looking for the big contract. I know he deserves it. You know, I know I love Texas. I really enjoy playing here. But I don't think 1 year is going to get him to the point where he's ready to give the Rangers a hometown discount. I think this is the time he needs to cash in.
Yeah, after the Rangers lost the division series, he really spoke so beautifully of the Rangers, but also just the patience that they had with him, the fact that he was changing positions. I mean, everything that was happening, and that he feels like he's so much more of a complete player now. And so it was nice to hear that he really did have some gratitude and that it really, you know, even if they part ways, it seems like it would be, you know, a very amicable thing.
Well, it was a great signing. And like we talked with Derek Holland in pitchers, everybody's looking for that one guy who they can, you know, get a cheap, maybe a one-year deal and at a good price and have that kind of a season. And the Rangers really scored big with Ian Desmond last year. And they'd love to have him back. If they don't get him back, you know, they maybe turn to Carlos Gomez, or they, you know, they go out on the market like it's something else. But center field is definitely their top priority, even though, you know, Delino DeShield is still on the roster. He was their opening day center fielder, you know, last year. Looked like he had a bright future, had a dip in production. Lost his job to Desmond because they had to fit Nomar Mazara in the lineup. But, you know, Delino DeShield is still around, and he's still candidates to play center field if they can't find a more, you know, experienced and more sure thing.
Well, the one thing that we know about the Rangers is that they're not going to be quiet over the offseason. So winter meetings could be very interesting. So we'll save a lot of that for closer to when that gets here. So, TR, thank you so much. Good catching up with you. We'll talk to you soon. The offseason is in full swing, but the Seattle Mariners are not taking any time off, as we see with some of the news that has come out about the Mariners. So let's talk to Greg Johns about that. I'm Allison Footer. Greg, it's been a while since we last discussed anything that had to do with the Mariners, but they did not wait around to start wheeling and dealing. So what can you tell us about some of the acquisitions they made, especially Carlos Ruiz?
Yeah, it's classic Jerry DePoto, as we've quickly learned here in Seattle. This is a GM who has a plan when he goes into the offseason. We saw it last year. He was really one of the first out of the gates with a lot of moves and kind of had an idea what he wanted to do with the roster. He's kind of started to do it again. He's not going to make as many moves this offseason, but the ones he has in mind, he's certainly in pursuit of. So, yeah, Carlos Ruiz, they traded for the veteran catcher to give him a backup to Mike Zunino, and a guy that can be both a mentor and a steady hand when he plays. Still got some tread on the wheels there at 37. So a good addition behind the plate. And then they went out and traded for Danny Valencia from the A's to kind of fill the first base hole. He'll work with young Daniel Vogelbach at first. And DePoto believes he also pretty good in the outfield, can help bring a much-needed right-handed bat on the corner outfield when he's not at first base. So he's a guy they expect to play close to every day, and they feel that's a pretty big boost with his versatility. They're not going to bring back Dae-Ho Lee, who was kind of a fan favorite at first last year and a big guy, but really pretty limited in what he could do, which was big guy with some pop, but really could only play first and not give much on the base paths or defensively. So Valencia, they feel a nice addition there, and they got a couple more spots to fill. But shoot, we're still 2.5 weeks from the winter meetings, even. So we'll see what happens here coming up.
Yeah. So when they look at the overall sort of the way the team is constructed, I know that they're not that dissatisfied with the overall look at the team, and these are things that we'll get into closer to the winter meetings, but just as a reporter who's covering them every day, do you see like a lot of other areas that need to be corrected or added to, or what do you think they're going to do?
Yeah, the big one, Allison, is a lefty, or probably two at least, in the bullpen there. That's an area that they traded away Mike Montgomery. They traded away Vidal Nuno here this offseason to get Ruiz. And that was an area they were shy on anyway. So definitely a spot. They're going to go out and get a quality lefty. I think if they make a move in free agency, that's where it will be. I think Brett Cecil's the guy that is on their radar, certainly. A couple other decent names out there, Boone Logan, Jerry Blevins from the Mets, maybe even Javier Lopez, the older age, I think 38, 39 with the Giants. But they're going to add, either by trade or free agency. There's no doubt they're going to bring in a lefty, because right now they've got David Rollins, who's a Rule 5 guy from 2 years ago, and Pat Vendetti, the switch pitcher, who's a great story and can be a lefty specialist to some degree. Really only the lefty relievers they've got on the 40-man. So Ariel Miranda, who's contending for a starting spot, could be a lefty if he doesn't make the rotation, but obviously you can't count on that if you're fighting for a rotation spot. So yeah, I definitely see that as a spot. Even with Valencia being available in the outfield, I still see him going out and getting an outfielder. Photos talked about Ben Gamel being an everyday guy in left, and that's certainly a guy they like that they brought in from the Yankees at the end of last year. But he's a guy with about 40 major league at bats. So I suspect a team that's wanting to compete now is probably going to want to go out and get a left fielder. Nori Aoki is now. They let him go. He picked up by the Astros, so that's a spot that I definitely think they'll be looking to upgrade. And still talk of a shortstop. They got Ketel Marte. They can certainly live with him. They were a little disappointed last year. They do like him for the future, but that could be a spot that they go out and get a veteran. Zach Cozart, the name that keeps popping up, is a guy that they were interested in at the trade deadline last year. Didn't pull it off. It could be a name still on the back burner there. So still some moves to be made. With DePoto, you just never know. I mean, maybe he pulls a big trade and surprises people. Maybe he stays working around the fringes and keeps adding, upgrading where he can at each spot. So we'll see. It seems to always be a pretty interesting with DePoto in the offseason. Not a guy that's afraid to make moves.
No, he's always been very aggressive, which is good news for Mariners fans. Are there one of the main questions that you hear this time of year from fans is just concern about like where the payroll is. Do you see anything massively changing? Are they going to be able to add? Do you think they've got a pretty decent payroll? So I guess you don't see any major cuts coming is the main thing.
They certainly won't go down. And they went up a pretty good chunk last year. In fact, they went over where they expected because if you recall, Asashi Iwakuma was the guy who had signed with the Dodgers and they expected to lose. And when they had a chance to bring him back, the deal fell through with the Dodgers and they said, hey, let's go get this guy and went out and spent on him. And so it bumped up the payroll a bit. And I expect it'll bump up a little more again. They were close to $150 million last year at the end of the year. The thing with them, I mean, that's a good sized payroll, but they have a big chunk of it, you know, going to a few guys, which is where you got to work around, and those guys are on long-term deals. So, you know, Cano and Felix make, you know, $50 million between the two of them. Nelson Cruz got a big deal. Kyle Seager's getting bumped up this year as he gets further in his deal. Iwakuma is a fairly high number. So I think between those five, they're like $89 million just for those five. So, you know, that and then they got some guys that they're getting bumps this year that are arbitration eligible, and the Paxton, Taiwan Walker, a couple of those guys are going to make more than they did. Leonis Martin will get a nice bump. So you know, you start to eat away even without adding new players. Your payroll is getting eaten up. But they do have some space they cleared, letting Aoki go and some other moves. And I expect that payroll will get bumped up a little. So they've got money to spend. They're definitely not, you know, people want to say, oh, go get – you know, Cespedes, go get, you know, Jose Bautista. That's not the position they're in. You know, they've got so much in long-term deals already with a couple guys. They're not going to add another one of those big blockbuster deals. It's just, unless you're the Yankees or Dodgers, you just can't have three or four of those kind of guys. And you know, they'll be more of a team adding, you know, a couple, you know, I don't want to call them fringe players, but you can upgrade with guys that aren't, you know, Cespedes. You can make moves that fix your, you know, add to your roster, and that's what they're going to do again. I think build that depth, you know, get a better lineup 1 through 9 and keep building that way. And if they did that last year and improved 10 wins, if they can improve, you know, a few more wins this year, they're right in the thick of the playoffs, and, you know, that's where they're trying to get.
Yeah, and someone will overpay for a Jose Bautista. They'll sign into a contract till he's about 40, 41, and then express dismay when he's is no longer productive at 40 or 41. So I always wanted like the teams that I was always pulling for to like steer clear of the, you know, the 37-year-old free agent who came off a good year.
Yeah.
Okay, so the last thing I want to ask you is about Felix. So he's going to play in the Venezuelan League. You know, I'm concerned about this just because I'm a naturally cynical person, so I'm already thinking of all the extra work he's going to put on. So he's going to pitch in the Venezuelan League, then he's going to pitch in the World Baseball Classic, and he missed 7 weeks, of course, we know last season with a strained calf. So talk me down from the ledge and explain how this is all going to work.
But you know, it's interesting because I probably think like you do, Allison, and I remember that it was the last day of the season last year, and there's a few of us talking to Felix after the last game, and you know, what's your plans for the off season? What are you going to be doing? And he said, "Well, I'm going to pitch in the Venezuelan league." And you know, my eyebrows shot up. You know, he hasn't pitched in the Venezuelan Winter League since 2003 when he was like 17. You know, this is not something a 30-year-old major league ace does, is go play winter ball. But it's interesting. You know, he said he was going to do that, and they play in the WBC. And of course, a lot of players are going to play in the WBC. So, you know, I kind of kept in the back of my mind, and we'll see how that plays out. Is he really going to go pitch in the Venezuelan League? And I talked to DePoto a couple of days ago, and ran a story today or yesterday, I guess, on Mariners.com. But you know, DePoto says, yeah, we kind of like the idea. You know, we don't want him to show up in March, try to get ready, and then go, you know, pitch big. Pitch counts in the WBC. We're fine with them going and pitching, you know, building up a little bit in the Venezuelan League, not going crazy. They'll monitor it closely, have them, you know, start out slow and build up a few. He's not going to be pitching 9 innings. He's not going to be throwing 100 pitches, but you know, get him going early. And they really like the idea of him working hard this off season with a definite early goal to get ready for the long haul. And there's kind of some sense that he's got to change what he's done here. You know, he's 30 years old now. Things didn't go quite as smooth last year. You know, he's going to have to change some things, and they think one of those things could be just working harder in the off season to get ready earlier and be ready. So, like you, I, you know, I, boy, how's that work when he gets to September next year. I guess if everything goes well, maybe they look back and go, this was the perfect solution. So we shall see. DePoto said he's not concerned about that. He's much more worried about a guy trying to build up real early and pitch in the WBC without being ready. So his thought is this is a better way to go, and we'll see how it goes. The WBC is an interesting concept for pitchers, especially, to get ready early and throw innings. And there are some rules to protect them in the WBC that they don't go crazy on the innings or pitches, but it is a different schedule. And Felix, a guy traditionally who gets ready later than anybody, he's the last guy to start pitching in every spring, and that's kind of been his routine. So definitely it'll be a different spring for Felix, and we'll see how it works.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to keep our eye on that. The WBC is going to be just add another element for everything that we're talking about. So it's fun to start talking about it now. So thank you so much, Greg. Appreciate it. And we'll see you soon at the winter meeting.
Sounds good, Allison. Good talking to you.
Thank you.
The funny thing is when you talk to the Angels, you talk to the players, you talk to the coaches, you talk to Mike Socha, general manager Billy Epler. When you talk to them about Mike Trout, they don't mention that he is the best player in the game. They don't mention that he impacts games all sorts of ways, that he wins games in center field, that he wins them on the bases, that he hits with power. They just mention the kind of guy he is, his approach to the game. There's no funny business with Mike Trout. I don't even know that he wants to be a star. All he wants to be is a baseball player. When Alan Gonzalez covered the Angels for MLB.com, you'll never forget the first spring that Mike Trout was in the big league clubhouse. He comes over to Alan and he says, "I think Albert Pujols knows who I am." And that reflected a youthful enthusiasm and an energy. And the weird thing is, after five full seasons, five of the best seasons any player's ever had, that's still the guy the Angels know. He's engaged with the fans. He's engaged with the community. But basically, he's a guy that shows up in jeans and a T-shirt every day and wants to play baseball. And right now, when you look at this guy, you say, we're seeing something. At least now sometimes you don't know how good a guy's going to be. This guy's 25 years old. When you watch him play, this is as good as it gets. Well, I was thinking about this. This must be what it was like Robinson at 25 or Mickey Mantle or Willie Mays at 25. This guy deserves to be compared with any player. He has led the American League in wins above replacement all five of his seasons in the big leagues. He has won the MVP award twice. He has finished second twice. I mean, he's finished second three times, and he's won it twice. He's led the league in runs four times. And the thing about Trout is when you go to a game, I went to a game with a friend last year, and I said, the Angels have the best player in baseball. I'm not going to tell you who that player is. I want to see if you know by the end of the night. I remember Mike Trout didn't have a hit that night, but Mike Trout got on base. He stole bases. He set himself up to run, and he made a couple of fantastic plays in center field. He just does things that when you're watching on TV or you're at the ballpark, he brings you out of your seat. And I think the drive that was there in those first years when he thought Albert Pujols maybe knew his name, the enthusiasm, the energy, all that stuff has never waned. And his talent's off the charts. In a lot of ways, this second MVP award was more deserved than any of the others. His 991 OPS tied a career high. He had a career high 116 walks, he led the majors in 123 runs, and he just does everything. I mean, 32 doubles, 29 homers, 30 stolen bases. He's got so many ways he can beat you. The Angels, there have been stories through the years that have talked about, especially over the last year or two, maybe the Angels should trade Mike Trout and get a passel of young players, take a step back to move forward. Knowing Mike Socha, knowing Billy Epler, the Angels would never do that. They have to trade the kind of player that every franchise is trying to get, the kind of player that comes along maybe once a generation, maybe once every other generation, would be asinine. Instead, you build around this guy. You go get as many parts as you can to give Mike Trout the best chance to win. It was a breakthrough that he won the American League MVP award in that it's only the sixth. He's only the fifth player from a losing team to win the MVP award. Ernie Banks did it twice. And that's the voters focus on winning sometimes, neglecting that that's insulting to the way Mike Trout approaches it. And also, why punish Mike Trout for the things that he can't control? All he can control is his game, and he does it better than anybody. So when he's at your friendly neighborhood ballpark or he's on your television in next season, take a moment to watch him. This is the kind of player that doesn't come along very often.
MLB.TV Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.TV Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go. Every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.TV for details.